To badquaker.com podcast. My name is Ben Stone. Today is Tuesday, November 13th, 2012, and this is podcast number 229. As is usual, I'd like to mention real quick that we do have a forum for Bad Quaker, for the Bad Quaker community. I guess we're starting to become a community. That's what a forum does. We've almost got 90 members over there. It's growing steadily, and there's all kinds of stuff to talk about. Just go to badquaker.com, hit the button on the upper right-hand side that says Bad Quaker Forum, and you can look it over and have a peek at it. You can see a good portion of it without even, you know, creating a logon or anything. So that's my little commercial for the forum. It's growing nicely. I need to spend a little bit more time over there. I have been busy lately, but anyway, okay, so there we go. Now, the other thing I wanted to mention was yesterday I was talking about music, and I had intended on saying one other thing about it, but I got wrapped up talking about my son and the intro music and, you know, him, you know, he's going to make me a grandfather here in about a month. So I got distracted by those things. And I forgot to mention, you know, music is very much like anarchy. Now, I'm not talking about chaos, and I'm not talking about what, you know, what the government wants you to think of when you hear the word anarchy. And I'm not talking about what the mainstream media thinks of when they say anarchy. But if you think about what music really is, for a musical piece to work correctly, for it to be enjoyable to the ears, there are very hard rules that you have to follow to create that music. Now, a lot of people know this, you know, by nature. If you take a natural musician that just, you know, a person with a natural beat, and they just naturally pick up a musical instrument really quickly, really easily, a lot of the, what you might call laws of music are hardwired into a person's brain. Now, you can learn these things. A person who has very little or no musical talent can learn a tremendous amount about music if they take an interest to do it. But there are people who, you know, my dad was one of those people. He was a natural born musician. And I have a little bit of those tendencies. I just don't have the interest in it, really. I like music, but to be a good musician, whether you're naturally gifted or not, to be a good musician, you really have to put a lot of effort into it, and you have to practice constantly. And I never really, it never took that place in my life that I could really put that kind of effort into it. But as a kid, you know, my mom played the guitar, my dad played guitar and mandolin. I was exposed to music. You know, my dad was in a band for years and played music. And so, you know, I was exposed to that kind of thing growing up. And there was always, I shouldn't say always, very often there would be extended family members that would come around, especially for the brief period that we lived in eastern Kentucky in the Appalachian Mountains. There would be just spontaneously five or six family members, which, you know, from the extended family would show up. And the next thing you know, music's happening. And it would just be, you know, an event that just spontaneously took place. And among my family in eastern Kentucky, that kind of thing still happens. They just, you know, by random chance, if four or five of them get together, typically three or four of them will have a guitar or a banjo or a mandolin or something in the trunk of their car. And the next thing you know, you got music going on. But my point in all that is that, you know, music is inside. It's hardwired inside some people, and the understanding of how timing works, and the understanding of how rhythms work and how each of the aspects, and I don't even know enough about it to really even speak on it with any kind of intelligence, but what it takes to make good music is naturally born in some people, and other people can learn that. But one way or the other, good music will not take place unless you follow those rules. But there's no committee deciding what those rules are. And whenever you get a situation where specific people decide that they're going to lay down hard rules and say this is what music is going to be like, music stagnates. And then spontaneous music will erupt and come out of it. Like, for instance, if you think about music, the music transformation or the transformation that took place in music during the 20th century, by the end of the 19th century, there were music professors that were saying, this is exactly how music is supposed to be. You have to have this kind of timing. You have to have this. You have to have this. And then there were these uneducated crazies who just went out and started making music on their own. You know, ragtime and jazz and things like this were birthed. But really they were there all along. They were just incarnations of some older type of music that was in there the whole time. And so all these new forms of music started popping up in the 20th century that broke all of the, they didn't break the real rules of music, but they broke what the rules that the professors were teaching, that music has to be like this. But they were following those age-old music rules. And in that sense, that's exactly the way real anarchy is. There are rules, there are laws, natural laws, that exist whether or not a hierarchy of human beings sit around and decide on those laws. Those laws exist. Humans tend to cooperate with one another. And when we cooperate with one another, life is easier on all those involved in the cooperation. But as soon as you begin to outline the rules needed for that cooperation, you start to have malfunctions in that cooperation. So that's why central planning can never produce as well as spontaneity does, because spontaneity is driven by human desire and by the need for each human to do that which they perceive as best for them. That's Mises talked about that as praxeology. Humans tend to do that which they perceive as being in their best interest. But when you get a lot of people together, or even a few people together, and they start to plan something on behalf of others, now you've got people who are unnaturally attempting to make decisions for other people, when in fact it's the natural tendency of humans to first think of yourself and first try to satisfy your own desires. So when you're unnaturally forming a committee to decide what's good for other people, then you're already at a disadvantage. And that's the difference between central planning and just spontaneity of anarchy. And taking it back to music, if you think of music, I remember seeing Frank Zappa. When he was very, very young, Frank Zappa appeared on a television program. And he played the bicycle. He played the bicycle. He turned a bicycle upside down, and he had a pair of drumsticks, and he had a violin, a bow, and he had several other things like that. And he engaged the hosts of the TV show that had him on. He engaged them in banging around on the bicycle and so forth. And he made music, and it was actual music. I mean, it wasn't an orchestra. It certainly wasn't, you know, that type of music. But because to Frank Zappa, because the rules of music, the laws of music were built, he's passed away, but because the rules of music were hardwired in Frank Zappa, he was able to, even with a bicycle turned upside down, a pair of drumsticks and a violin bow, he was actually able to make music. And you know, the other two guys that were helping him were also natural musicians. Even though they were hosting a TV show, they were both actually musicians as well. And so as soon as Frank started setting the beat and setting all the aspects of the music, at first it was a little awkward. They were just banging around on it. But after a very short period of time, they all just synced into each other and they started making actual music with a bicycle. And I'm bringing that up because, you know, that is the perfect example of anarchy. This is how anarchy works. And I was talking about my family getting together a minute ago. I regularly use my family reunions as an example of anarchy. We have, you know, it's kind of out, away from everything. It's away from any kind of big towns or anything like that where we have our family reunion in Eastern Kentucky. It is planned in the sense that we decide on a day. But that's about the only, and a location. We decide a day and a location. It's typically one of two different locations. In most cases, because the population of my family is starting to get older, most cases nowadays, it's at the same house. It's at my aunt's house. We used to have it at a place that we called the camp, which was a sort of a rustic, beside a small river. And sort of a rustic campground there, but it's a little harder for some of the older folks to get in there, and parking's a little bit more difficult to try to, you know, find a place to park alongside of a river and not get caught up in a ditch full of mud or something like that. So we have the last few years we've had it at my aunt's house. And nobody says, you know, okay, you're going to bring the potato salad and you're going to bring the chicken and you're going to bring... If nothing is planned, there's no rules. Nobody says... There's a lot of my family are teetotaling Baptists and a lot of my family are not. But there's no rules that says, you know, you can't drink beer or you can't have any alcohol or you must drink alcohol if you want to come here. There's no rules like that. They just show up. And there's no rules like you must be armed or you cannot be armed. There's no rules like that. And there's not even any rules that say, you know, you can't argue or you can't fight. There's no rules. And yet my family gets together and there are people there who deeply dislike each other. And you know how they handle that is they just don't talk to each other. They just talk to other people. They don't necessarily confront each other. Although, you know, sometimes somebody's in your face, you have to tell them back off. But in all the years that my family has had these family reunions, we don't break out into any kind of wars of any kind. There's no fighting, there's no battling, and there's no police, and there's no laws, and there's no rules. There's just civil behavior. And if you don't want to be there, don't be there. And if you're there and you don't like the way things are going, you can just leave. And that's what anarchy really is. That's how anarchy really works. And in a very real sense, that's how music works. If you you go to a music studio and you have the whole corporate structure there and they take a person and they bring them in and they put them in the right costume and they comb their hair the right way and they put a microphone in front of them and they have this composed piece that they want the person to follow along with, then you get a kind of music that, you know, maybe it will appeal to some people, but it just doesn't have that same tribal pureness that you get when a bunch of musicians just get together in a garage and just start banging something out. You know, you'll never get if you're in I don't call them records anymore, but if you're in the music industry and you're some guy behind a desk who's not really a musician, but he looks at a formula, this sells, if we do this and this and this, this will sell. And so they can actually produce music that is marketable and that sells. But it doesn't stir you the way raw music does. You're not going to, you know, you turn on the radio and you're listening to some FM channel and you're listening to the latest pop music. It's not going to have the same effect as if you go see real music live. And that's the difference, because once you get people on a stage with instruments and even if there's a certain amount of choreography that goes on, or even if there's not, you still have the spontaneity of the moment, and you have far more power and far more energy is flowing both on the stage and in the audience. That whole expression of music, it can't be locked down in hard rules, dictated through written laws, and to say, you know, all music has to do this and all music has to do that. Because when you do that, the music begins to die and it becomes sterile. And eventually, in the marketplace, that music will be pushed aside and forgotten. But the more spontaneous music will always find its way to the surface because it's coming from deep within humans. And that's the difference between any kind of central planning of any kind of hard writing of laws that are inflicted upon humans by other humans. That's the difference between true social interaction, just between people getting along and doing what comes natural to them, as opposed to enforcing of laws. You think about opening a door for someone. If you go to a grocery store or whatever, and almost all doors in the U.S. nowadays are automatic opening and closing. So I guess that's a dead argument. But you go to some place that doesn't have automatic opening and closing of doors, like maybe a bank. Oftentimes a bank doesn't have automatic doors. So if you're going into or out of a building like that, and you see an elderly person, or you see a person with little children or something like that, oftentimes you'll open the door for them or hold the door open for them as they try to get through, as they try to manage the door while, you know, dealing with little kids or an elderly person with a cane or something. But there's no law that says you have to do that. And yet, not only do people do it, but it's also kind of expected. It's kind of, and at the same time that it's expected, almost all the time there will be gratitude when you do that. If you hold the door open for some old person or somebody who's struggling with a bunch of little kids, there's almost always a gratitude that's there. And even if there's not a gratitude, you still feel kind of good that you helped somebody. As a matter of fact, that's going back to Mises and praxeology. Even in doing something kind like that for somebody else, you're really doing it for yourself. When you do something that you know is right, even if nobody sees it, even if no one ever knows you did it, when you do something that you know is good and is right and it helps other people, you get a feeling inside, a sort of a self-rewarding feeling that encourages you to do that again. You see, people are always motivated by something. Every action that a person takes is motivated by something. And every human being, deep down inside, is motivated by wanting to do things that make them feel better, that make them more secure, that make them richer, that make them have a more comfortable life. This is why we do everything that we do. This is the essence of praxeology. So people act based on what they perceive as being best for them. They're not always right. Humans are not always correct in our judgment. But that's what our attempt is. Not long ago, my wife and I received a gift card from one of the listeners, and we appreciate that very, very great, very greatly. But the company that sent us the gift card messed up and sent us somebody else's gift card also. We got our gift card that we were supposed to, but the company messed up and sent us someone else's gift card as well. And it was like $100, the mess up that was supposed to go to somebody else was like $100 gift card. And it had a note with it, and it was for the people's anniversary. And now that gave us a couple options. Here's what we could do. We could just ignore it and throw it away. We could attempt to use the gift card. I mean, after all, it's $100, and we could probably use it before the gift card company figured out the mistake. So we could throw it away, ignore it. It's not our business, right? Or we could try to use it. There'd be a slight risk that it would be canceled and we wouldn't be able to use it. But there's no repercussion for using it. And after all, according to the law that the government says, if you receive something in the mail unsolicited, it's yours. You're under no obligation. So there's nothing against the so-called law, the government law. There's nothing in the law against us just using that card. But my wife and I didn't feel like that was the right thing to do. So my wife called the card company that issued this gift card, and she said, "Hey, one of you guys messed up. You accidentally sent us this $100 card." And they thanked her, and they corrected the mistake, and they sent out the correct card to the correct address. Now, that made my wife feel really good, because rather than just throwing it away, and rather than spending it herself, she made sure that the gift card went to the couple that was having their anniversary. And they'll never know that. And the gift card company doesn't care, right? So what motivation caused my wife to do that? Well, because she enjoys feeling good. And when you do something good, there's a little self-reward. You feel do something good. And this is a huge motivator for human beings to make us behave in a way that helps our fellow man. And now, how does that relate to music? Well, you know, why does a person play music? Why does a person compose music? Why do they spend hours and hours and hours practicing to make good music? Is it just to serve the public? Of course not. It's because they feel good in doing it. They feel good in satisfying that need, that desire to create music, so they do it. But you can't legislate music. You can pass all the laws you wanted to, saying this is how music must be done, and you and you and you and you must play the music. And you know what you'd get? Really, really crappy music. I'll be right back. Did you know author Taryn P. Lupo has a new novel out called One Nation Under Blood? When a rejuvenative blood technology is developed that pits the young against the old, the government must take firm steps to address the war of supply and demand brewing across generational lines. Blood is not the only thing bought and sold in this dystopian tale of technology, economics, and independence. Vampires are now very real, but we never expected them to wear our grandmother's best Sunday dress. Would you like to do something to support BadQuaker.com? Here's how easy it is. If you're already going to buy something from Amazon, go to BadQuaker.com first. Click on any of the buttons for Amazon. Once at Amazon, shop like you normally would. You'll pay the same price for the things you buy from Amazon, but Amazon will give BadQuaker.com a tiny portion of that purchase. It's amazingly easy to shop at Amazon, it won't cost you any extra, and you'll be supporting BadQuaker.com. Thank you. Okay, thanks for sticking with me. So I was talking about music as an example of anarchy and how anarchy actually produces the best music. True anarchy, spontaneity, the creation of the music just out of sheer desire to fulfill your own needs. That's the best way to create music. But if you lived in a world where the only music you had ever encountered was government produced, was produced through forced production. If people were captured at around the age of 4 or 5 and they were held captive for, you know, 6 or 8 hours a day, and they were forced to learn music for like 12 years. And then they had to go through a series of tests and they were licensed, or they had to go back to school and learn more. And certain people, not everybody, but certain people were chosen by the government, and they were forced to produce music like that. Now, theoretically speaking, of course, music could be produced like that. But think for yourself what that music, how appealing that music would be. But what if that was the only music that was allowed? And what if no other music was even a possibility? And what if you lived your whole life, not just your life, but your life and your father's life and your grandfather's life and his father's life and his father's life? What if for generations the only music that people had ever heard was government-produced, forced music? And then what if somebody came along, somebody like Frank Zappa, and just turned a bicycle upside down and just started wailing on it with drumsticks? What would be the response to that from people, do you think? Well, first off, there's a problem in my scenario. You know, you could never do that with music. You could never keep people down, because the desire to hear music and the desire to make music is far more powerful than any government law or any government agency or anything. It could never be controlled like that. But if it could, you know, just for the sake of conversation, if that were possible, then without, you know, Frank Zappa whipping a set of drumsticks out and turning the bicycle upside down, without that happening, if you just sat down and talked to somebody and said, you know, I think music would be better if it was done on a voluntary basis. If you said this to someone who had never heard such things, who had for generations only heard government mandated and issued music, how difficult would it be to get them to buy your story that music could arise spontaneously and could be produced by people voluntarily? How difficult would it be to get someone to understand that? And yet that is exactly the situation we're in with law. Someone railing against me in Facebook the other day, some idiot flapping his mouth, not knowing anything he's talking about. One of his accusations against me was that I'm crazy and I live in a fantasy world and I want to get rid of all law. Well, I don't think you can get rid of all law because, gravity is going to attract, matter is going to attract a matter, that's gravity. Matter attracts matter. And there are certain laws of motion, and there are laws of thermodynamics, and there are laws, affecting everything in nature. And so you're not going to get rid of laws. Now, are you talking about specifically petty little rules that one human writes on a piece of paper and then tries to force another person, another human being, to obey by those? Is that what you're calling law? Well, if you're only going to define law as that, then yeah, that should be gotten rid of because there's no actual reason to do that. There's no actual reason for one person to sit down and scribble words on a paper and then try to inflict those words upon other people. There's no logical reason to do that other than the desire to control other human beings. Now, there is a great word for some people, not for everybody, but for some people in society, there's a great reward that comes to them when they can manipulate and control other people. As a matter of fact, it's not a large segment of humanity that feels that way. It's a very tiny percent of human beings that have this raging desire to control other people. But those people, if I say they're not normal, that doesn't quite fit the analysis. And I'm not educated in the realm of psychology to diagnose the exact mental problem that they have. But that's really what it is. When you have a person who is obsessed with the idea that they need to manipulate and control everyone around them, and that everyone has to obey their will, and that they are so godlike that they can decide what law is, and that you have to obey that. That's not normal. That's not a normal aspect of the human experience. Now, humans do tend to want to get along with one another, and humans will put up with a lot in order to get along with each other. And sometimes humans will say, all right, you want to play your little law game, you can be in charge of this. As long as I can get by on a day-to-day basis and not have to deal with you, that's fine. And so we tolerate these lawmakers. We tolerate them as much as we can. But throughout history, whenever these people have gotten too pushy with their laws, what do? Well, humans strike back. Now, mostly that's in the form of revolutions, and mostly revolutions start like that. People just sick of being pushed and sick of it, instant domination by this tiny group of humans. So revolutions start typically with the bulk of people just getting sick of it and deciding, you know what, that's all we're going to go, we're not going any further, and this is going to end. But then something, every single time there's a revolution, this happens. Some point in that revolution, there's this perceived need to organize it. There's this perceived need to have a leader, to have somebody who can take this movement by the reins and guide it so that we can all come out the other side better off than we were. In other words, you've got one of those same people who wants to make up law that decides they want to be in charge of the revolution. And when the revolution's over, you have a worse mess than you had before the revolution. And that happens every time, every single time. And it doesn't matter. You know, it's been argued. Even Murray Rothbard made the argument that there have been two justified wars that that the United States has been involved in. One being the War of Independence, and the other being the South, the Confederacy, defending themselves against the North. And that's the only two wars in Murray Rothbard's mind. That was the only two wars that the United States government was ever involved in that were morally justified. But the problem with that is, and I tend to agree with Murray Rothbard on many, many, many things, but the problem with trying to justify either of those two wars is you have to look at the result. What was the result? And did the, and normally you don't say, well, the ends justifies the means, so I can rob this old lady as long as I feed the children with it, right? So I'm not trying to say that the ends justify the means. That's not what I'm saying. But what I'm saying is when you look at war and you look at the result of a war, did it accomplish what you said that it was going to accomplish? Then how, if it did, then you have to look at other factors as well to see if it was morally right. But if it didn't accomplish the original intent, if the original intent was good and it didn't accomplish that original intent, then was the war good? Was the killing of lots of people, was it good if it didn't accomplish what it was supposed to accomplish? So if we look at the War of Independence, and I keep saying War of Independence because I don't like calling it a revolutionary war. The American War of Independence was not a revolutionary war. The colonists in North America were not attempting to have a revolution. They didn't march on the Capitol. They didn't march on London. They didn't attempt to overthrow the government or kick out Parliament or kill the king or any of those things. So the War of Independence was not a revolutionary war. It's interesting that this government would lie to us for years and call it that. The government loves to twist history and lie about words. But so the War of Independence was fought for what reason? Well, some people, and when Kai was on the show the other day, I kind of debunked this a little bit. Some people will tell you, you know, well, it's the right to vote because we had taxation without representation. Well, first off, if that was the reason, then it failed because people could vote before the War of Independence, and the taxation that happened as soon as the Constitution was adopted and the new government was formed as a federal government and Washington began using troops to enforce the whiskey tax, the tax on Americans was already worse than they had ever faced under the British. So if it was if the War of Independence was a war to stop taxation without representation, like the government schools tell you to believe, then it was a failure. Because those people in Appalachia that Washington marched his troops out and murdered, those people had no ability to vote. And, you know, all the black slaves in the U.S. had no ability to vote, and women had no ability to vote, and children could not vote. And so there was taxation without representation. People in Appalachia had no way of voting about whether or not there was going to be a whiskey tax. They were not represented in any way Appalachia itself was just absorbed by the new born federal government of the United States, and the Appalachian people were not consulted on that. They were just absorbed into it. The Appalachian people had left the colonies and gone into Appalachia separate from the British people and from the British government. And they were already living separate for literally 100 years, some of them 150 years, living in Appalachia separate from the colonies and separate from the British. And then some guys in Philadelphia wrote on a paper, and Appalachia was absorbed into the new government without the permission of the Appalachian people. So if the War of Independence was fought to stop taxation without representation, it failed in every way. If it was because, you know, the British were the British were violating the rights of the colonists. The British were, you know, housing soldiers. All the different, if you read the Declaration of Independence, all the accusations against the king and against the British government, if those were the if that's what the revolution, the sorry, I almost said it myself. If that's what the War of Independence was fought for, then you just look around at your at the next TSA agent that you know, that feels up your grandma, and ask yourself, well, was that War of Independence successful? Did we get that? Did that work? How'd that do? So that means that the War of Independence did not free anyone. It did not stop taxation. It did not guarantee representation. It didn't do any of those things. It just accomplished swapping one despot government, swapping one ruler for another. That's all it really did. It swapped the thugs in London for some local thugs. That was the only difference. What really was the difference between members of Parliament and guys like Alexander Hamilton or Mason? Well, George Mason was a lot more libertarian. I shouldn't have picked on him. I should have said Madison. Madison was a nasty little guy, you know? And Washington was not a good person. I've talked about him before and his tendency toward theft and his tendency to take troops into battle, fighting, you know, stealing Indian lands simply because he had done the surveying on it, or he had hired the surveying. And so by killing Indians and driving them off land in Ohio, he owned that land personally. He personally owned that land. Look into the history of Cincinnati and the entire Miami River Valley, and you'll see what I'm talking about. That's just swapping one owner, one nasty government for another. Well, so wasn't accomplished. So was that war really justified? Well, and let's think of Murray Rothbard's argument on Lincoln's War of Aggression. Was the South, was the Confederacy justified in fighting the North? Well, again, all you're really talking about is swapping one master for another, swapping one nasty government for another. And so when the swap first takes place, maybe the new government's not quite as bad as the old. But in every case throughout history, it's just a matter of time, and we're right back to the way it was before, or worse, and usually worse. So does that mean that the Confederacy was somehow... that it was somehow a just war? Well, I don't see how you could make that argument, because it was still going to be a government. Whether it's 13 separate states, each of them with a government, inflicting it upon 13 separate geographic areas, or whether it's one big federal government inflicting its will upon everyone, you might be able to make the utilitarian argument that, well, you know, a smaller government is easier to control. Well, yeah, a smaller gang of thugs is less effective than a larger gang of thugs, but that doesn't morally justify having a gang of thugs making up your laws for you and enforcing them upon you at their will. Having laws that only apply to you and don't apply to them, because that's how it always ends up. So, if not, and I won't make all the argument that Murray Rothbard makes about the War of 1812 and the Spanish-American War and the War with Mexico and the World War I and World War II. I actually had notes today to go through those each one at a time, and maybe someday I'll do that. But the real point, I think, is in recognizing the difference in having people be able to just spontaneously recognize what is good and what is bad and naturally follow those rules. Like I was talking about with a musician. That's how society tends to go when society rejects the idea of having a very tiny little group of people making up laws, writing them on paper, and then inflicting their will upon everybody else. When you have societies that allow that spontaneity, then, and there are many of them. There are many of them today that still exist. I talk about Zomia pretty regularly. It's in Southeast Asia, in the uplands of Southeast Asia. And, you know, there are other societies as well. And throughout history, that's the default of humanity, is to be in a society where there are no leaders. And of course, there's always going to be natural leaders. But I'm talking about this odd little group of people who feel it, who enjoy dominating the rest of humanity, the rest of people, by making up laws and then inflicting those laws upon them. Societies have existed throughout the centuries without that, and they function just as well. When I get back from this break, I'll maybe talk about that a little further. So stick with me. BadQuaker.com uses HostGator as our web hosting service. It was fast and easy to get set up, and the support we receive is top-notch. They have helpful and friendly 24/7, 365 live technical support and a 99.9% uptime guarantee, and they have some of the best prices in the business. If you have a website, or if you want to have a website, check them out by going to badquaker.com and click on the button for HostGator. And thank you very much for supporting badquaker.com.
Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle, Volume 1. Basic Handgun and Rifle with Jared Waltz.
First rule of being alive is you own yourself.
A groundbreaking approach to firearms and self-defense training. Beautifully filmed and easy to understand instructions make this one a must-have. Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle, Volume 1. New DVD from Michael W. Dean. Available on Amazon.
Okay, now, so I was mentioning societies that exist without governments, without top-down management and written laws. And, you know, a lot of people don't realize that the bulk of history, the bulk of human history, humans lived under those circumstances. If you look for the actual lifespan of the state, and let me give I haven't done this in a while, so let me give a real quick explanation of the difference of how I look at government and how I look at the word the state. I see the government as the people and the buildings and the tanks and the aircraft carriers and all that stuff. Those people in uniform, those people with fancy titles, those people who either are what we consider, you know, normally think of as the government, and those people who work for them and enforce that upon the rest of us. I see all those people as the government. The guy, the dog catcher, the county commissioner, the president, all military personnel. This is all the government. But I see the state in a completely different way. I believe the state is the mythical thing that people believe in that justifies the violence of government. Now you get, I was talking about my family and family reunions. You get the family all together, and it was always very apparent at family reunions that my dad was kind of in charge. Now when I say in charge, he didn't give orders to anybody or anything like that, but he was the central figure and recognized as, in essence, as the elder. The funny thing is, there were people there at all the family reunions. There were always people there that were maybe 15, sometimes 20 years older than my dad, which is saying a lot, you know. My dad was pretty old before he died about a month ago. But, just as, you know, out of nature, there are people who rise up as natural born leaders. And there's nothing unnatural about that. There's nothing crazy about that. There's nothing, you know, odd or abnormal about that. You always, anytime you get five or six people together and throw a basketball out into the middle of them, and you will naturally see leaders form, and you'll see teams. This is all natural. This is all spontaneous, and it works. And so the same thing happens anytime that you have a natural setting. So like with my family there, my dad would always sort of stand out as the as sort of the elder, but he didn't have any authority to inflict his will upon anyone. And if had he tried, he would have lost his position as that natural leader, because that's the thing of it. A natural leader doesn't try to inflict their will upon others. So here you got this old man who is not even the oldest one there and yet recognized as the leader. But he's not trying to inflict his will on anyone. He's not trying to force laws on anyone. And that's how societies, how natural societies develop. And that's how humanity functioned through all kinds of tribal situations and all kinds of clan societies throughout history and throughout the world. Now, the exception being in tiny little river valleys, typically river valleys, like the Nile and the Ganges and the Yangtze, typically you would get some despot, some robber, some thief, that would gather around himself a gang of thugs, and they would raid where it was easiest to raid, which is oftentimes in the river valleys. It's really easy to defend yourself up in the hills, up in mountain hideouts. It's really easy to defend yourself. But if you're down in a river valley where the ground is really nice and fertile, it's really easy to grow, especially grain crops. It's really, really easy to grow grain crops down in those river valleys. But it's also very difficult to defend yourself in a place like that. So early on, and we're talking, say, prior to 9 or 10,000 BC, something like that. The only existence that we can find, or I should say, everything that we find from societies prior to 9 or 10,000 BC, they don't show any indication of walled cities. They don't show any indication of a state. There are settlements. There are lots of settlements that are older than 9,000 BC, but there's no indication of a city-state, the city-state being the oldest form of state that we know of. The first city-state that we know of appeared in the Jordan River Plain, near what we now call the Dead Sea, at Jericho. And I've done several articles about Jericho and talked about Jericho, but I haven't talked about it much lately. And Jericho is 10,000 years ago or so, 12,000 years ago, it was a lot more fertile than it is now because there was more rain. The weather was different then. There's been a pretty dramatic weather change in the last 10,000-12,000 years. So it was watered a lot more than it is now, naturally. And it was a very fertile plain, so there was settlements all up and down the Jordan River Valley. And we have evidence of these settlements going way back beyond the time frame that I'm talking about. But we know that somewhere around, 8, 9, 10, 12,000 years ago, something like that, a very small garrison was put together on a mound in the Jordan River Valley. And that mound is called Jericho. And, we know it was a very small garrison. Because we found the evidences of, I wasn't there, but you know what I'm talking about, modern humans, have found evidence of the original wall and the original tower from Jericho. And it was very small. It could only house maybe as little as 20 or 30 people, maybe as much as 50. But it couldn't house the inhabitants of the entire valley. So we know that the people in that garrison were... And it was built on a natural mound that was there, a natural outcropping of rock. So we have this tiny little garrison in this big fertile valley with lots of farms around it. And so why would a small group of people fortify themselves like that in a place like that? It wasn't big enough to hold all the occupants of the valley, but somebody was in there. And I, like I've said in my other articles on this topic, and you'd have to listen to them to get into it more in depth. I don't have time to go into the whole thing today. What's clearly the case is that a robber's roost, so to speak, developed there. A group of robbers learned that they could stay locally rather than moving from place to place, which most robbers would do in natural circumstances. They found out that they could fortify themselves in a tiny little garrison. And if they could keep themselves safe from the farmers, then they could ride out from that one central location and rob the farms. And at some point in time, this developed into the first city-state. And really, that's all the state has ever been. It's been a tiny group, or it's been the belief, the justification that it's legitimate. You see, when this first started, of course, the farmers would not have recognized that as being legitimate. But some magic thing had to take place to convince the farmers that the thugs that were riding and stealing from them somehow had the legitimate authority to do so. And I'm not going to get into that whole thing today, but that's the birth of the state. When you switch from just having people who live off of you forcibly, people who forcibly live off of your labor, when that changes from being thugs and thieves to you accepting that as legitimate government, when that magical transition happens in your mind, you believe in the state. The state is birthed at that moment in your mind. And that's the realm of the state. The realm of the government is these people who inflict their will upon us. But when you believe it in your mind, that's when the state is born. So the state is an entity that exists entirely in the minds of humans. It is that which makes the government legitimate. It's not the government itself. Something, if there was no belief in the government, if we didn't believe, if we all understood that all government is organized theft. It's just the biggest, most successful gang. That's all it really is. That's all it's ever been since day one. And the moment that your mind switches and you understand that, the state ceases to exist in your mind. There is no longer a state. And as more and more people accomplish that, as more and more people see it, then the whole facade falls away. And we understand that a state is just not necessary. And again, this has been the case for most of human history. I was talking about those little river valleys. That's where the state was first birthed. The state being, again, that concept that these thugs are legitimate. They have a right to do that. And originally it was, and I've talked about this before with Tammuz and several other deities that were used to convince the people that there was a justification for this behavior. So initially, it was a religious belief that these thugs had some kind of, special dispensation from God to do this. That was the initial catalyst that caused people to accept in their mind the idea that a small gang of thieves can rob you on a regular basis and dominate your life and tell you, you can go here and you can't go there. I'll give you a written permission so that you can pass from this place to that place. The whole idea that that's legitimate came from this religious belief that this gang of thieves was given to us by God or by a God or by a deity or whatever. And initially, that very first one that we know of was Tammuz. Well, it's fake. It's a fake religion. This whole idea that there are some people that are commissioned by God to tell you how to live your life. The moment that the realization comes to you that they are no different than you, they don't have any kind of a special connection to God. They don't have any kind of special connection to any kind of deity. Tammuz is not real. Once that dawns on you, then the state no longer exists to you. It evaporates. It's just gone. It's like a mist hit by the sun. And that's that magic moment. And humans have lived under those conditions throughout history. It's only in the last 8, 9, 10, 12,000 years that people began believing the myth of the state. For thousands and thousands and thousands of years across Northern Europe, across Northern Asia, throughout Africa, throughout the America, well, North America and South America, Central America had, they believed in the state pretty heavily there for a long time. But for centuries prior to that, human beings interacted, had villages, lived their lives, made music, without anyone writing down a single law and inflicting it upon another human being. It just didn't happen. It didn't exist. And yet humans, without this myth, without the belief in the state, humans figured out that you can take a rock and pound on things with that rock. And that You pounding on something with a rock is more effective than pounding on it with your hand. And then humans figured out if you took one rock and another rock and you used pressure just right, you could make a knife. And once you've got a knife and you've got a hammer, well, it's a rock, and there's, you know, ways that you could shape that rock so it made a better hammer. And all these were done without the state. And then pretty soon, somebody figured out you could put a lever to work with that hammer and that knife. And now all of a sudden you've got a spear and you've got an arrow. And now next thing you know, you've got a way to measure things. You know, I've talked about the arrow as being the standard rule. The arrow was a rule for a long time. And the only ruler that we had was the arrow. And that not in a violent way, but it could be in a violent way for self-defense. But the arrow was the length of a man's step. It was the shot of an arrow was the distance of in every direction that a man could possess land, because that was the distance that he could control land. It was roughly 1 acre. So a man could own an acre, and a man could protect that acre. As a matter of fact, he had the right to shoot anybody who came in that acre. And that's and humanity developed like that. I did a whole podcast just on the arrow. I might have done two or more. Anyway, as you understand, history is not what the government tells us to believe. It's not the story that the government gives us. The real history of humanity is a history of humans living without government, getting along, utilizing things like the division of labor. You know, money developed long before there was ever a government. And I mentioned, the blade, the hammer, and the lever. These are the foundation of civilization comes on these three tools. And then you add in fire later on, and then you add in the wheel. And these things all developed without a government, without any law, without any small group of people dominating the rest of humanity. And most humans lived in a stateless society until very recently. And even as recent as the 1800s, think about North America in the 1800s. The influence that the governments actually had in North America was tiny in the 1800s. Most people living in North America in the 1800s had very little or no interaction with the government. That allowed them the freedom to invent, the freedom to discover, the freedom to create wealth, and the freedom to trade, all without government interference. And you look at the explosion of invention and the explosion of wealth and the explosion of population that took place from 1800 to 1900. Now, governments were growing at a blinding pace at the same time, and they were bringing the wrath down upon humanity, and, you know, through terrible wars and so forth. But still, the bulk of humanity was not under the control of governments during the 1800s. And yet we went from 1800, we the fastest a human could move was as fast as a horse could take us, which is only slightly faster than what a human can move on their own. And by 1900, just 100 years later, there were contests to see which man could come up with a machine that could carry him the fastest. And that was a fascination to do that. Because all of a sudden we're going from traveling maybe 20 or 22 miles an hour to men who could travel 60, 70, 80, 100 miles an hour in 100 years. And that did not happen because a government decided it. And it did not happen because some central planner decided to design a way to make a machine so that transportation could be advanced into a new realm. That didn't take place. What took place was individuals saying, looking at something that another individual had done and saying, you know what, that's cool, but I can do that better. And nothing stopped that person. There was no regulation stopping them. There was no law keeping them from innovating and changing it. But government didn't like that. Those people in government that want to control everything, they had, in the 1800s, they decided, well, we have to start inflicting these copyright laws on everybody and these patent laws on everybody. And we need to stop these people from making things that somebody else has already made. And we need to stop these people from changing things that somebody else has already made. So government was not in innovation. Government was in stopping innovation. Government did everything it could in the 1800s to kill and to murder and to stop individual achievements. But the will of humans was so great, and the desire of humans, it's like what I was talking about with the music. If there was a way, if it came into the attention of government that they needed to stop, all private production of music, and they needed to regulate and control the production of music, they'd never get away with it because the human spirit desires freedom. And of all the expressions of freedom, music is probably the most primal. Music is, it's probably the deepest, next to reproduction, and lots of people will argue these two things are deeply connected. Reproduction and music are deeply connected. But other than reproduction, music is probably the most primal urge that humans have. And we do it entirely spontaneously, naturally, following laws. All music follows these laws. And it's all good music is voluntary. Folks, for more on liberty, the Zero Aggression Principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. Thank you very much for listening.